waiting, written about, all that. It doesn't matter. It's a balance. It's a balance. But when the car is in, the tires are in the water, then the property of that balance changes. And then So yes, we have a balance, and especially when we have a grand plane, actually, before I go to that, I recall the screwdriver antenna. When people have a screwdriver antenna at the rear of the car, and then they have a small resonant circuit between the end connector or whatever connector they use for that antenna and the body of the car, to match impedance and also balance in it. And then after I finish, Dr. Ray, you say which part you disagree with, because I'm trying to challenge it. And grand plane antenna, the counterpoise wires are angled downwards to lower the feed point impedance closer to 50 ohms, improving the match to common coaxial feed lines. I believe it's 130, 140 degrees. I'm not sure what is the angle of it. But also, we're talking about the balance, and has nothing to do with the ground, because that ground plane could be 40, 50 feet above the actual ground. But I'm going to risk the statement, at the end of it, I'm going to risk the statement. Every ground could serve, if we really want, as a balance, but not good balance, just as a balance, but ground cannot serve as a balance. Counterpoise cannot serve as a ground, but ground could serve as a counterpoise. Back to you.
Yeah, basically, a ground is a poor substitute, but, I guess a poor substitute is better than no substitute. But counterpoise or radials or other such are part of a balancing and unbalanced antenna.
Yeah, additional thing is, when I was looking at the counterpoise of the vertical antenna, let's say, we have a vertical antenna on the ground and we have a counterpoise, and we have a wires with no insulation on it all around. And then one thing is, for me, kind of interesting. It doesn't matter what is the conductivity of the ground. Is it wet? Is it dry? Is it sand? Is it gravel? Or whatever it is. And whatever is the condition for a given day. The counterpoise gives more steady environment, more steady value as a counterpoise by itself. So if we had only the ground that is used as a counterpoise, it would very much change. But the counterpoise by itself is not changing that much. Back to you.
Okay, I mean, basically, earth ground can have different characteristics. They implemented antenna calculating, plotting devices that are capable of inserting ground conditions. You know, there's a big difference between using broken up granite stones versus sand next to an ocean. So, yeah, earth ground is much more flexible definition than a actual counterpoise, which is a relatively conducting piece of material. You know, you wouldn't use a semiconductor for your counterpoise. So it's less variable than earth ground, which can be almost anything.
The next one. Famous face optically encoded. So we have a CNC machine, which the name Exeron, E-X-E-R-O-N. And then we have acoustic lens. I'm not sure how you pronounce it, acoustic lens. And CNC machine was able to manipulate with the piece of acrylic to the point at which when you put through that sort of lens a light, you saw the picture of Marilyn Monroe. If you don't mind to comment on it, Dr. Roy.
Okay, I mean, once again, this strikes me as an incredibly visual situation, which is not amenable to radio. I mean, basically, it looks like a very distorted lens that focuses light at a certain focal length to reproduce an image of Marilyn. Interesting, nice to watch, probably a little bit less nice to just hear about it. You know, I mean, you kind of miss the pretty nature of the video, where the guy puts it into a machine and creates it out of nothing and shows it on the wall. So it's interesting to get to see the YouTube and to hear us chat about it. I don't know what you're going to get out of it.
Yeah, interesting is that it was shown on the YouTube channel of the Titans. The guy from Titans was a former convict. He was in jail for many years, and then after he got out, he decided to pay attention to machinery and metal and CNCs of different kinds, and now he's a billionaire. Going to the next one, VPN versus proxy. Let me drop. Okay, so we have Russians. They still spend money to lure Western world to Russian spy platforms. And I have some text where I mentioned two platforms. But of course, they could use our AI for their own benefit. So the two of them is Surfshark and Kaspersky. Surfshark is European VPN service founded in Lithuania and headquartered in Amsterdam. So it looks like it's not a Russian platform. It's like, it looks like Russian have nothing to do with that. But Lithuania borders with Russia, and many businesses out there were under Russian influence, to be gentle with words. So we don't know what is the connection. However, Kaspersky has faced allegations of ties to Russian intelligence, leading to the U.S. government banning its software from federal use due to national security concerns. The company has consistently denied those allegations, asserting that it does not assist any government espionage efforts. Well, we know that there are many Russian lies or Russian government lies around, and they don't have a problem with it. But we're talking about VPN versus proxy. So if you don't mind, Dr. Roy, say a few words about the difference and similarities back to you.
Okay. Proxies are rather inexpensive and low-tech. They're simply aliases to different ports. So instead of going through your internet service provider, you're going through a different configuration. It's very easy to trace it, so it's not terribly useful. Virtual private networks, VPNs, are a little bit more sophisticated and esoteric. What you basically are doing is bypassing your internet service provider. You are taking your packet requests, encrypting them in a way that your internet service provider cannot decode, sending it off to a third-party server, the company that's running the VPN, which decrypts it and then establishes the packet link that you wanted to. It's not foolproof. Some people think that they could do torrent and not be found out. It's very easy to discover who you are with torrent, and people have gotten all kinds of legal judgment despite having a VPN. It's a nice, inexpensive, simple approach if you happen to want to use your laptop in a cafe with the cafe's wireless access and you don't want people sniffing your traffic. A VPN is a relatively simple approach to guard against people sniffing your traffic and taking the passwords that aren't encrypted that are going through the Wi-Fi connection without a VPN.
Okay, so we understand that for general privacy, we rather use VPN. For bypassing geo restrictions, we use proxy. Sometimes there is a message saying this video is not allowed in your geographic location or whatever. But that would be VPN, not a proxy. I'm not sure. Secure online banking, definitely VPN, and my basic web browsing is proxy. And the question is a router in your network a proxy?
Not sure what you mean. There are routers that can be configured to operate a VPN. A lot of times, unfortunately, that's not possible. So you run it on your computer, you can run it on your cell phone. It's a VPN that you hide your geographic location. But that's not foolproof, because a lot of companies that don't want you to use a VPN have the IP addresses of every VPN in the world. So if you are going through a VPN, it can recognize that and disallow the connection because it's a known VPN.
Okay. My suggestion was that if we use Tor-based browser, like Mullard, somebody didn't hear about that Mullard, then nothing is recorded. It's like an onion. So Tor is like an onion. Before somebody would be able to get to the very center of it, it takes too much time. It's too late. True or false? Back to you, Dr. Ray.
Generally speaking, Paul, you have to believe these people. They have no particular proof. There are people who suggested that onion and Tor were originated by the CIA. So you can imagine that they very possibly built a backdoor. It's the same thing with VPN. VPNs can either record your traffic, even though it's encrypted across the internet, decrypted when it gets to them. So they have the capability of recording every single contact that you made. But, you know, if you read enough of these things, they will tell you, I won't say that it's true, but they'll tell you that they do not record them, or they erase them at the end of each and every day. And so even if they get served papers, they have no record. And then you find out years later that they did have records. So you're basically taking people at their word. There's no way to kind of prove these things, unfortunately, only in retrospect.
Thank you very much for that. The darker side of VEVOR, V-E-V-O-R, VEVOR, and what you need to know. Okay, it is politically incorrect to say Chinese junk, and if you try to make a comment on Amazon about a junk from China, they take it, but you cannot find that comment in the comments. They will say, thank you, so many guys saw it, but you cannot find it. So we may say junk from China, and all of that would be rejected. You would not be able to see it. I'm not sure how to properly say the phrase that would contain the words China and junk. Could you suggest me some form of it, Dr. Roy?
KG2RY.
Yes, David?
Do the providers of VPN have access to the data you're sending and receiving?
Well, if you do not encrypt it yourself, yes, they have the decryption technology. Anything that you send to a VPN unencrypted, although it becomes encrypted through the VPN software, when it gets to the VPN server, they decode it.
Can the VPN provider hack your data?
If they were malicious, possibly, but unfortunately, for the most part, they'll tell you that they never do that, and it's up to you to prove them wrong.
QSL.
Okay. Anyway, getting back to VEVOR, I don't know if most of you people out there know, because these Chinese companies, they come and go. VEVOR is a weird Chinese company. They themselves do not manufacture anything. They're a very big company with lots of money, and what they do is they go to companies that are bankrupted and going out of business and have an inventory. They buy up all of the inventory and they sell it. So unfortunately, there's no particular quality assurance control. If they bought up a manufacturer that had good quality assurance, then they have good equipment. If they buy up inventory from a terrible company, they have terrible. So there's nothing really standing behind their name. They're simply a distributor of bankrupt companies, which isn't particularly a good place. Right. But they act as the main distributor, and they sell to big box stores all over the United States.
Okay, and they were in 2013 selling in Lowe's and Home Depot and Walmart. Before they throw them out, they opened up last week a humongous store in Houston, Texas, that would in design compete with Home Depot, Walmart, and Lowe's and others. And they are located, of course, in China. And if you don't mind to help me use the proper wording, containing words junk and China, that would be not offensive, and that would be just expressing what the person wants to express. Back to you.
I don't know. I would probably find some set of words that suggest that they don't manufacture any of these products, that they're simply sold off from out of business companies, and so the innate quality of the merchandise can be very erratic, both for the good or for the bad, and just kind of leave it at that, personally.
Okay, thank you very much for that. So we have VEVOR present in United States, United Kingdom, Australia, and Germany. And they say they serve 10 million customers globally, focusing on quality of customer service. What kind of quality If you look at some products that were available in Home Depot, I'm trying not to say the word because I'm not the name of it because I might be in trouble. But there were yellow color. Then you find exactly the same in Vevor from different kind of companies. It looks like they are buying everything what they can and then trying to sell it to United States and many other countries. But anyhow, is it worth to buy it? Back to you, Dr. Roy.
Well, yeah, that's their business model. There were American companies that did sort of the same, that bankrupted companies' inventories and resold them, and they bought them cheap, and they sold them at a reasonable profit. And the quality issues had nothing particularly to do with that company because they had not designed it, manufactured, or had any much to do with it. All that they're out to do is make a profit off of it.
Yeah, what scares me is 50,000 to 500,000 square feet of the floor with the junk that originates somewhere from out there. I don't know how to be more gentle in words. We have a subject for Paul. Paul, if you don't mind to comment on the event that happened on August 12, 2026. Paul, back to you.
Okay, Wes. No, very good. Yeah, well, you're talking about the eclipse. Wasn't much here. I think I have to send by that of the sun, and that's all you got. And I missed it because I was there visiting a doctor at the time, so there you go. I'll see you next time. You can always wait until the 18th of this month, and like late Thursday night into early Friday morning, 12:02 or so, you'll see an almost total lunar eclipse, not a solar eclipse. So we'll try to look at that. Hope the weather's good. A little over a week now. Anyway, back to you, Wes.
Okay, could you explain why solar eclipse was not visible in full across the entire region of Europe? Do
you? Or here, you know, like I said, we saw 10%. You know, so it's the you gotta, well, you have to imagine a shadow coming down on the earth, and if the shadow is only a part of that shadow is hitting your area, your city, that's what you're gonna see. That part's gonna be missing from the sun. The whole shadow is right, you know, completely overhead. I got a clear solar eclipse. They said it looked good up in Iceland and North Greenland, and then the way it traversed across the earth, wound up in Spain and France, I believe. So, you know, I don't know how the weather is with all the fires and everything. Maybe it was too smoky to see. I never did hear the results. Back to you, Wes.
Okay, so I understand that there is a narrow area where a total eclipse occurs, and outside of this spot, observers will not see. Partial eclipse, and that happened mostly in Europe. The last one for today is Asian carp. Yeah, it's a fish. The subject's title is Asian carps are vanishing from Illinois River. Alligator fish and use of transmitter injected to fish body. So there was a big problem a long time ago. Citizens of Illinois went to China and brought a fish. It was carp. And it happened that the population of that carp was so big that everything was collapsing all around. And they used transmitters injected into fish body. But then we have alligator fish, which is the ancient fish from the era of dinosaurs. That is, Roy, if you have any information, would you mind to say a few words? And to exceed it.
Not particularly.
Okay, so I'm going to present the subject. So the government of the state of Illinois thought that the ancient fish that looks like an alligator, but it's a fish, it has a mouth very much similar to the alligator, small alligator, that they would be able to eat enough of those carps. But what happened is that they had their mouth is too small, and those carps are quite big when they grow up. So, of course, it was a good that there were so many small carps, and the population was growing for that fish to survive, because it was at the edge of vanishing. But then the problem was still present, We're talking about that alligator fish. It's a 250-pound fish. It has torpedo-shaped body, a broad alligator-like snout, armored with diamond-shaped ganoid scales, and two rows of sharp teeth in the upper jaw. And eventually, government decided to pay 10 cents per pound in addition to the price for the fishermen. And that helped. But they also used another technique. Two nets. So you have a net from one side, you have a net from the other side, you have a boat in the middle, and you banging the bottom of the boat with the hammer or whatever, scaring those fishes. They're going towards the net, and then the other net is getting closer. So now it looks like those fishermen found the solution because of the 10 cents per pound in addition to the price. I'm not sure, because they were using a poison, they were using different techniques, nothing helped. The beginning of the story was that those carps were not intended to be in the Illinois River, but they had a float, and those small ponds, when they had that carp, were flooded, and that's why that the fish was able to escape. Any comment, Dr. Roy, back to you.
No, not much.
Okay, so we have a problem solved. It looks like a population of the carp for the first time from the past 4 years is 40% smaller than it used to be, and it looks they find a solution. That would be all for me. It's interesting if somebody look in the internet to see how the alligator fish that existed in time of dinosaurs and still survives till today looks like. And there are fishermen in Illinois River showing the big fish, 300-pound fish. I'm not sure why that fish has never bite anybody. Because if you look at it, it's scary. Anyhow, thank you very much, Dr. Roy. Back to you, and to XC.
Hey, WS2N. Okay, yeah. But Wes, I just want to bring up this one email he sent. You know, it's hard to describe on ham radio, but it's a couple of pieces of wood put together. And when you look at it, creates an optical illusion. It's a real strange effect. And then, you know, when you watch the YouTube, you know, this guy, and he shows you how he does it. He cuts up all the different pieces and the angles and everything. But I just want to let you know, Wes, I did look at that. I got a kick out of that. It's not, of course, you know, you can have it on radio. But if you had the website up, it's pretty interesting to look at. Back to you.
Dr. Roy, for your comment.
Well, I mean, that's pretty much what I said earlier tonight. That it's an interesting video, but it loses a lot in the translation to a radio.
Yeah, so that was, I'm not even sure what kind of wording could be used to present, to sort of paint the picture with words that would describe that effect. It's an optical illusion, Dr. Roy.
Yeah, if you could do that with words, that would be a far bigger thing, and no one would need television. But unfortunately, television is really optical illusion. You know, it's kind of difficult to get most of the idea of optical illusions across by just describing them with words.
Thank you very much, Paul, for mentioning it. Yes, I sent it for the amusement of you and Dr. Roy. I have no words how to say it. Maybe you can try it. Paul, you want to take a try?
You'd have to follow the guy's directions on how he cut these couple of pieces of wood up and how he glued them together and all. But when you look at it, it looks like, you know, if you look at it for 1 second, it looks like it's connected in a certain direction. And then if you blink, it now looks like, you know, it's completely connected in another direction, you know, the angles all change. But, you know, it's revealing when you look off to the side. If you had it in person, you would see it right away. But, you know, because it's a picture of what you're looking at, this thing sitting on a table, it gives you that effect. But the second, if you're there in front, if you move you to left or right, then you can see that it's actually an opening, and it's just the effect of waiting. Interesting, though. Just wanted to bring it up, let you know I watched. Back to you, Wes.
Yeah, last year I decided that since I no longer have the mechanical shop with the CNC lathes and mills, which I had as a part of the lab, I'm going to buy myself a wood shop. So I I put everything that a professional woodshop has just to play with it. What else is left? Thank you very much, and have a good one. Dr. Roy, back to you.
Okay, very good. By the way, there are a lot of 3D making models for those types of objects where if you align the image in a particular way, it takes on a erroneous three-dimensional aspect. So there's lots of them. I must have built a dozen or so of those when I was doing a lot of 3D printing.
Okay, that's all for tonight. Have a good one to everybody. Thank you for listening and to XGN.
Okay, no, thank you. Thank you, Wes, as always, for your participation. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight. I hope you had some fun. I hope you learned a few things, and I hope you'll join us next Sunday when we try this all over again. But it is now 10:16 and change. Certainly time for the SpaceNet report with full WS2N.
We could do that. WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. Okay. By the way, I talked about the lunar eclipse coming up. I don't know if I said the right date. It's the 28th. But I'm not sure. I'm not sure if I said that. Anyway, it's next. Thursday night. You know, between the 27th and the 28th. Anyway, the H3 rocket lifted off from Takashima in Japan Space Center. It's Space One to launch, and it went up successfully. They've had some troubles with the H3. Relatively a heavy vehicle, you know, for Japan, and it's the ninth one that launched. In the past, they've had problems with two of them. It's a new design. They went through two other H versions, H2A and the H2B. H2A was used for all launches, very successful, many launches with that. The H2A and the H2B was specifically used for launching cargo to the International Space Station over the years. They did that 9 different times, and now they've replaced both of them with the new design H3. And they use the word H because it's a hydrogen, liquid hydrogen rocket, of course, with oxygen as well. So they've designed it more power, it's less expensive to build. They're expendable, you know, there's no reusability involved, but it does make, you know, help them make their country competitive. And they're the one that's the HCV, now it's called the HCVX, is the cargo version to the International Space Station. I mentioned this before, they also had plans on restocking the space station that was going to be going around the moon, the Gateway, so it was designed for that as well. This new one is HTVX. Like I said, the regular HTV was nine launches. Each one was about 1 year apart, but this new version they've already launched one successfully to the space station, and probably launch an average of one to the space station. Will they be able to do what they wanted to do in the future? Send cargo maybe to at least lunar orbit? They could have to do it. You know, I'm sure they haven't given up on that idea, even though the Gateway has been canceled by Jared Isaacman and the new NASA administration, unfortunately. So let me just drop it. Okay, let me just talk about Elon Musk. He has plans of getting that Starship into orbit eventually, but he also has bigger plans. He wants to buy up thousands of acres of land along the coast of Louisiana. And the article said 130,000 acres of land. I mean, this is going to be like thousands of times bigger than what he had down in Boca Chica. That's what, you know, that's where he launches the Starship now. So, he's got enough money, I guess, to buy up all this land. But he is getting pushback from the people that live there. So that remains to be seen. He wants to buy all this land so he could launch countless rockets from Louisiana, as well as Florida and Boca Chica. and he's also got launch facilities in California. But as of now, there were no planned Starships to launch from California, but he planned on launching them from Louisiana. If that doesn't work out, he's also trying to bring back the idea of using offshore oil rigs. He planned to do that, I don't know, maybe 8 years ago or so. He bought up two platforms, oil platforms, and was in the process of converting them. But then he put that on hold. He even gave them names, Damius and Phobos, named them after the moons of Mars. So, you know, he has these wild dreams and doing things, puts money into it, and then puts it aside. And now, from what I read, he's planning on bringing that back to life. And his goal is to launch hundreds of, if not thousands, of these Starships over the years. The plan for all these flights will be for data centers in space. We've talked about the feasibility of doing that in the future. You know, millions of flights would be required, and, you know. So, you know, in his mind, he needs a tremendous amount of land. So he wants to buy up all the land. And when I say a big piece of land, 30 miles long along the coast, you know. So, you know, it's what people do when they get enough money. They don't know what to do with it. You know, they always buy up Twitter for $40 billion. That's what it costs them. What's it going to cost them to buy 130,000 acres in the coastal land in Louisiana? I really don't know. WS2R. Okay, nothing heard. Anybody have any comments or questions or anything? Just thinking about the next topic I was going to talk about. You know, I want to talk about the what they plan on doing with some of the equipment that was supposed to be, you know, set for a gateway. Let me just drop and see if anybody has any questions.
KC2SHO, just saying, we're here listening, and we do appreciate it, even if I don't have any comments at the time.
Very good. And, as New Mexico, I mean, you're transmitting yourself from there.
Monmouth County.
Yeah, there's always a lot of space activity in that state, you know. I hope they bring back the Starliner, and they can start landing the Starliner again in White Sands, New Mexico. Anyway, I was going to bring up the Halo. You know, it was a module that's really almost completely built by NASA. And Halo is an acronym for Habitation and Logistics Outpost. They planned on launching together with the PPE, the Power and Propulsion Element, which was also, you know, on its way from, you know, being complete. They were going to bolt these two together on Earth, put them in a cargo bay of not a Starship, but a Falcon Heavy, you know, and that's a Elon Musk rocket right now that actually works. And they were going to launch the two of them together, and they were going to put them into orbit around the moon. But, of course, now that's all but canceled. So what do they do with all these billions of dollars that they've already poured into these two modules? Well, the Power and Propulsion Element, which is, you know, what it says, is a module that has a bunch of very big solar arrays, roaster solar arrays, that's rollout solar arrays attached to it to create power. And they plan on producing like 60 kilowatts of power with this thing. And all that power was going to be used to drive, I believe it was four ion engines, all effect thrust engines. And, you know, you could lift them things up and, you know, got some kind of propulsion out of it. I mean, you can't leave Earth with it, but you can move pretty good in space. Probably would have had maybe about 10 times the amount of power that, you know, some of the earlier designs of ion thrusters have. So they're going to take that, and they decided, well, we'll use that to Mars. So they were going to build this, I guess you want to consider it a solar-powered vehicle to go to Mars quicker with this kind of propulsion. But instead of using the solar rays, plan on putting a fission, probably going to be 235 uranium as a fuel to create enough electricity to power all these ion engines and everything else on board on the spacecraft. And the goal is to get it to Mars fast. Usually minimum amount of time is around 7 months. Typically they have 7 months to launch from Earth to Mars. You know, they do that when the two planets are near each other. And that happens roughly every 2 years, back almost 27 months, but roughly every 2 years, the two planets are very close to that. And they can get, you know, 6 or 7 months out of it. So with this thing, they're expecting to increase that. Although I haven't heard what their prediction would be. But, you know, let's say 4 months, you know, if they cut 3 months, you know, actual human flight to the future. you know, cut down the amount of food that you need. They cut down on the amount of radiation that you're going to get. The amount of fuel that you would actually need could be cut back on. So this would be the first, solar-powered interplanetary vehicle that will be built. And then when it gets to Mars, they like the helicopter right here, the Ingenuity helicopter that flew on Mars. It was supposed to do no more than 5 flights. They would have been happy to get 2 or 3. It was so successful, they did 72 flights with Ingenuity, a smaller spacecraft that was released by the rover, and finally eventually quit after a couple of years. Had a camera on board and all kinds of, you know, computer equipment to figure out where it was every time it landed, make sure it didn't land on a rock. Amazing helicopter. Big 4-foot blades, two blades. One spun clockwise, the other one counterclockwise. So with that success, they figured, well, we're sending this nuclear-powered rocket all the way to Mars. Let's power it up, with a nuclear fusion. And when we get there, we'll have our payload. The payload's going to separate from the nuclear-powered rocket. And the payload's going to be 3 helicopters. It's going to come through the atmosphere with a parachute, ETO parachute, and then when it gets near the surface, instead of landing like Perseverance did the rover, and then releasing the helicopter, when it gets near the surface, it's just going to, it's going to drop the heat shield, and that will expose the 3 helicopters. And they're going to be released one at a time and fly down to the surface to do their work, and then, they have onboard solar panels, and they'll be able to fly from, location to location. That's their plan. Do I believe that's going to happen? Maybe, but their time scale is way off. They're saying within a couple of years. Sounds like, 2030 thing to me, minimum.
Hey, you could field a question.
Sure, go ahead with question. WS2N.
Yeah, hey Paul. It's Jeff from Pelham. The question is, and obviously this is I'm a neophyte when it comes to space travel, obviously, but my understanding is when you send something faster out into space, if you want to decelerate it, you need to spend just as much time decelerating as you spend accelerating. Is this a flyby, or is it supposed to decelerate somehow once it gets there? If you're shortening the time to get there, you're going faster, and somehow you gotta decelerate if you're gonna drop a payload, or am I missing something?
I haven't heard yet, but I know. If you're gonna get up to speed, I guess they could turn this whole thing around and keep the eye on engines firing to try to slow themselves down at some point. I don't know yet. I'll look into that. I saw a preliminary drawing of this thing, and it's still got solar panels on it, so I guess they could power it with that at some point, and then light up the engines with the new, an actual vision system. By the way, I don't think the public's gonna be crazy about launching this. First it's gotta come to the Earth's atmosphere. Last time they had a problem with a regular RTG, radioisotope thermoelectric generator, they had 2 of them on board Cassini when that thing launched, and there were protests. They had a hard time getting past all the protests. The idea of this thing going down and contaminating part of the Earth was pretty much unacceptable. Even so, they've done it many, many times before. Cassini, they had a hard time with that one. They're gonna have a bigger problem. Instead of just being a boxed up situation like the RTGs, they produce around 109 watts of power. This thing's going to be produced, I don't even know how many thousands of watts of power. It's a regular fission reactor. Is the public going to allow that? I don't know. They really don't. They could say, okay, we'll start it up, once it's on the way to Mars. But still, if a launch vehicle fails, comes back down through the atmosphere, that could be a big issue. Although they have, with the RTGs anyway, they test those things. They crashed them into the surface of the Earth at high speed, hit it with all kinds of munitions. That held up. I'm not even sure what this thing's going to look like yet, Jeff. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm assuming they go through all the safety protocols, what have you. I think the protests are mainly from lack of knowledge or information, but we'll see. You're messing around with fissile material, so an impact would be interesting, at least. And it would be an effective dirty bomb accidentally.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it won't explode, but it'd definitely be a dirty bomb. We'll see. They poured all this money, NASA did, into PPE, a power propulsion unit, and the HALO, the habitat.
and, you know, they're trying to save face. Okay, well, now we've got a purpose for this other thing. You know, we're not going to waste NASA's money. So we'll see how far that goes. Now, the HALO, that's another story. That's the Habitat module. They said, okay, well, we'll use this thing. It's not going to orbit. Maybe we can, you know, put it on the surface of the moon. That was the first thing I heard. But if you look into the building of this thing, the Habitat module is really built to orbit the moon like forever, which means, you know, you pressurize the inside and you got a vacuum on the outside with, you know, no stresses, no, you know, all even pressures. It was designed like that. You put this thing on the moon, first of all, you know, as it lands on the moon, it was designed for, you know, that kind of stress, you know, if it had like a rough landing. It's also not designed to be sitting on the moon's surface, where you got big temperature changes in the surface of the moon. You know, it was designed to have even heat all the way around. In fact, you know, all kinds of internal piping and everything to keep it even. They won't have that on the moon. The radiation system situation could also be a problem, from what I read. And the main problem would be the, you know, access in and out. It really wasn't designed to be open and closed over and over on the moon with the regolith, you know, which is, you know, the dirt or the surface of the moon. It's like a, they call it, it's very, you won't want to get this thing stuff in your lungs. It's very abrasive, this regolith. So if that gets into the hatches, you know, even into the equipment, that might be a problem. So reading all of that, it looks like somebody must have, you know, realized the problems with actually doing that. So now they've changed it. They're saying, oh, okay, we're gonna still use the HALO module. They're not gonna use the module at all. They're gonna take the electronics and all the support gear and you know, the stuff, you know, the guidance control, computers, the stuff that was put inside, and they're gonna repurpose that and bring, you know, that will be part of the lunar surface project. I guess they're gonna have to build a brand new module to put on the moon, and then the stuff will become part of it. But again, to save face, they're saying, well, we're going to just utilize all the electronics now and all the stuff that, you know, that was inside the and everything, you know. So I don't know. We're going to see. Again, a long time. It's going to be a long time before we see parts of the HALO module, part of the lunar surface. Any other comments, Jeff, or anybody else?
I'm sorry, we transitioned to lunar modules as opposed to Mars modules. Obviously, there's a translation there, but I'm sorry, I missed the thread a little bit. And is it just we do kind of training missions, as it were, to the moon and then extrapolate that somehow to Mars? Can you help?
Yeah, there's two modules, right? So they were supposed to be attached together, and they were going to be part of the Gateway orbital system. You know, they were just saying this highly elliptical orbit, you know, 40,000 miles out, and it was like close to the moon around 1,000 miles, and that was going to be their orbit designed for that. Okay, so now there's a power propulsion unit. It's all canceled. We'll take that module, and we're going to make that part of a spacecraft that's going to go to Mars and drop off helicopters at Mars, three helicopters. And to do that, we're going to invent this fission unit to make electricity to power the thing, so it gets there quicker. Okay, we've saved the power propulsion unit, and that becomes a Mars mission. We're going to take the HALO mission, which was supposed to be the one that's going to go around the moon and hold the crew of four, and now we're going to put that on the surface of the moon, and then, you know, so yeah, you're going to take two different modules that were meant to be together. They're going to send one off to Mars, and the other one's going to be part of the lunar surface. So back to you, Jeff.
I have no problem with decorating the lunar surface a little bit more. I won't be protesting anything. I'm interested in seeing what they do. AC2PL, back to you. Thank you.
I concur. I was very happy when Cassini got off the ground and flew to orbit Saturn all those years. That was great. Very successful flight. And, you know, being out by Saturn, they couldn't use the solar panel too far away, so they used the RTGs, the radioisotope thermoelectric generators, to power that all those years, you know. And, not only was it a great flight, you know, taking off from Earth, and all those years to get them to Saturn, and many years orbiting Saturn, they said the thing came back was just terrific. So, you know, hopefully they can do the same with the power propulsion unit that flies to Mars. I want to see these three helicopters. At one time, I think they said at one time they were going to release, you know, before they hit the surface of the planet Mars, and they were going to just like fly off, you know, and do that. And then once they land successfully, hopefully, each one would be able to fly to a different location. They're still working on the idea of bringing back those test tubes. You know, they got dozens of those, actually, there's 39 test tubes laying on the surface of Mars right now that Perseverance put all over. And it was, I guess, $10 billion mission that was planned for years, where they would go out and pick these things up with another rover and put them in a inside of a rocket that they were going to land on Mars. And that rocket was going to be, you know, launched from Mars. It was going to dock with a European Space Agency vehicle in orbit, and that deorbit Mars and head to Earth with all these test tubes on board. But, then they realized, we might not be able to send a rover. Too expensive, so we'll send the rocket that's going to return these things. But now we're going to send, at that time, one helicopter, one of these Ingenuity type of helicopters, and we're going to fly around to the different locations and pick up these test tubes that are laying there. They know exactly where every single one are. I mean, get covered up with, you know, dust or anything like that. You know, we take, you know, 100 years. So they were going to pick them up in the helicopter, bring them over to the launch vehicle, and use that to launch back to Mars. That was all, you know, they kept changing the idea of how they were going to do this. And then finally they got to the point where they just canceled the whole thing. The price started getting too high. But they had these tubes laying there. You know, they're going to take one or two of these helicopters that land on Mars, and are they going to launch and land somewhere near where Perseverance is? Land somewhere, you know, where that rover is, and then be able to fly to all different locations, and this thing going to be able to pick up all the tubes and at least put them in one spot, and then hopefully someday in the future send another vehicle to Mars with another rocket. By the way, that was all planned. I mean, Northrop Grumman was building this rocket that was going to launch from Mars, you know. I mean, they could still do all this stuff, but I'm not holding my breath. Any comment? Okay. Anyway, there's an EVA planned a couple of days. That was on the 18th. And today is 16th. 2 days from now, on the International Space Station, you have two people that are going to go out. Anil Menon, he's from the, from NASA. He's going to be one of the EVA people. And then Sophie Andonaut is the European Space Agency woman. She's originally from France. And they're going to go out on a 6.5-hour EVA a couple of days now. And the goal is to disconnect a broken antenna. It's an antenna that they usually use, a number of antennas, but this one is one of the ones that they use to communicate with Earth. And I'm assuming it's one of the ones that would, communicate directly with Earth. Because most of their transmissions, they transmit up to the TDRS satellites, the tracking data relay satellites, and those things redirect their signal back down to Earth, and that's how you get all the videos and all the communications. But apparently there's one of them. It sounds like to me, although I haven't confirmed it, that this is one of the ones that just would communicate with Earth. Anyway, eventually I'll find out. This thing is broken. When I say broken, it's not like it hit with a rock or anything. It must have a low noise detector on it. It must have some kind of electronics on it. Maybe it's a... it's got an ASL motor system, I haven't heard. Maybe that's broken. So anyway, they're going to disconnect this thing, and they need a new one. But NASA, in their wisdom, many years ago, figured for all the stuff eventually would fail. So they put these gigantic pallets in different locations on the International Space Station many years ago before the shuttle was retired. So what they're going to do is disconnect this. Eventually, they're going to store that, and then they're going to bring back another one that's up there from the pallet and install it on the, they call it the Z1 truss. There's 11 different truss sections on the International Space Station. You know, you have like 15 different modules, but you also have these trusses that that are in line one after the other. And on the trusses, they have these massive heat rejection panels, you know, filled with ammonia. Get rid of the heat. So you have those things, and then you have really big solar panels. You know, collectively, it's like I think they're up at around 105 kilowatts of power that they get from the solar panels. But you know, all this stuff is attached to these trusses, And, you know, they have the port side that one goes out one side, you got five of them that go out that way, and another five go the other way, and then you have another one attached to a discovery module, which attaches to all of these, you know, as the main truss section. They call it a Z1, the zenith position of the space station. So the Z1 truss has all tons of equipment, all wires and cables, and it's a rat nest of stuff. So they're going to have hands full trying to disconnect this antenna and putting a new one on. So we'll see how that works. They're talking about 6.5 hours, and usually they have other projects that they're going to do, or other things that, you know, from what I understand, this is the only thing that they need to do. So replacing a failed, and they've done this type of thing before with the different antennas, cameras that go all over. You know, eventually they fail. I think what happens is the cosmic rays get to the electronics, and eventually they quit. Any comments? Okay, nothing heard. I just want to talk a few seconds about Blue Origin. It's Jeff Bezos' company. Jeff Bezos of Amazon. He has Blue Origin, and he has a whole plan of putting, again, millions of rockets into space. And he's the company that's put up 98 people that they have launched on suborbital flights on the New Shepard rocket. And now, for temporarily anyway, that's canceled. They're putting all their manpower and work load into getting the new Glenn rocket back into operation. So far, they've launched three of these things. You know, the first one made it to orbit successfully, which is unusual for, you know, brand new rockets when they're built. You know, that worked out okay. The second and third were launched successfully, and they also returned successfully on a barge twice. So they were going in the right direction until they tried to launch again another one, and that thing blew up. Now they found out the O2 oxygen valve on one of the B4 rocket engines blew. They, you know, I don't know if it was the valve itself. They said it failed. What was the piping that went to the valve? I don't know yet. But anyway, they said that they had to fix all this, and they're in the process of rebuilding that launch complex. The whole thing blew up when that rocket blew. Now they realized that they're going to need not only this launch complex, but another launch complex. They're launching over launch complex 36A. 36B is available, and they've now taken that over, and they've started reworking that. That was the original plan, but it is now, and they plan on making that even a bigger launch complex than the one that they were using for the New Glenn. They're also making an upgraded New Glenn rocket. The original one has, you know, seven engines to launch on the first stage. And then the second stage, they had two engines. They're called BE-3 engines. BE-3 engine, they know what they're doing with that one, because I think it's flown dozens of times back on Earth. That's the one that they use for the crew and the cargo into suborbital space, and it's a very successful engine, so they use two of them on the second stage. So they have a seven, and then they have two. But the new upgraded version of the New Glenn now will have nine engines, and, you know, for a first stage, instead of the seven, and instead of the two, the second stage is a four on, so they're going to call it the, you know, a 9-4 New Glenn rocket. But they need a bigger, large complex.
That time complete.
For that, but they're rebuilding that. They're building that. The other one they're rebuilding flew up. So then I have two side by side. We'll see how it goes. I really wish them luck. They were doing so good until that one failure. Elon Musk had many, many failures. I hope Jeff Bezos does not. He has a different way about him. They ran and tested a little on the slow side, but their theory is, you know, better slow than fast, and, you know, have to break and blow up. Elon Musk is different. Launch, it blows up, we'll fix it the next time. He's got a bike coming up at the end of the month. When I say Musk, he plans on launching another Starship. This time he's going to try to get into orbit. He's launched 13 of these monster vehicles, 400-plus-foot rockets, bigger than the Saturn V, or even bigger than the SLS at NASA building. We'll see what happens here. That should be the end of the month. He plans on getting into orbit, and then on top of that, well, the first stage, I guess he's still planning on having that go into the Gulf of Mexico, but the second stage is going to go around the Earth once. I don't know if he's going to do multiple orbits, but it's going to go around at least once, and then come back to Texas, come flying through the sky, and he's going to hope to flip it and have it come down vertically, and he he's going to have big arms come out on a launch complex, and he's going to try to catch the Starship. His goal is to do this over and over again. He's done it three times with the booster, so we'll see if he can do it with the Starship. I think he's got a chance, because he's done it a couple of times where you know, the Starship comes down vertically in the Indian Ocean. You know, all their test flights were suborbital, launched from Texas, come down in the Indian Ocean near Australia. And the last one was so successful, it came down vertically, and well, you know, a few of them have. And they know exactly, you know, where it is. And if they had some kind of a device to catch them in the middle of the Indian Ocean, it would have been able to do it. And in fact, Elon Musk is now even thinking of that, to have offshore launch facilities where he could not only launch these starships, but he could actually have them come back and catch them out at sea. So, I mean, you know, we'll see how he does. If he doesn't run out of money, well, he's the richest guy in the world. I guess it's still possible. We'll see. As normal, we'll follow it from week to week, and we'll be back next week to report on hopefully a couple of these successes. But now I'm looking at time. Let me slow down. I'll see if anybody has a comment before I do that. WS2F. Nothing heard. Roy, I'm going to turn it over to you. Fine, Mark always has another net on tomorrow night, and it always comes on 8:30 on these repeaters at Club Info and Net, followed by Swap and Shop, followed by Radio Newsline. Roy, over to you, AC2GS, WS2F. Put a space in that report for the TechNet. Over to you, Roy.
Okie doke, this is AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the Technical Net and all that you do for the Club. We all appreciate it, and I thank everyone and appreciate everyone for their participation tonight. I hope you'll return next Sunday when we try and do this all over again. As is my usual practice, let me tell you of some comments from two clever people, one our own Dick at KYW. Sorry about
anyway,
that.
Anyway, I was carrying no
audio.
WS2, W3 guys.
Okay, well, hopefully I'm back when along. I got thrown over all stars at the very end. As the KYW, you say, be kind to each other. That's always good advice. And good old hepatitis, impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So, happy to and if you possibly can, come back next Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we'll try and do this all over again. Say DCGS, and I will be clear.
Okay, came through on that. You break up once in a while, you know, including now, but eventually, I guess we'll figure that out today.
Okay, well, I mean, I am as well as what star. If it's the control leader, but hopefully it'll be quite next Sunday.
Very good. Have a good night, guys.